Coming up on the show today, Israel strikes the Jabalia refugee camp for a second day.
Israeli strikes have hit apartment blocks in a refugee camp near Gaza City for a second day in a row, causing many deaths and injuries.
Plus, the intentions of Hezbollah to Israel's north are still unclear.
Hezbollah is in a bit of a quandary because it has positioned itself as the chief resistance movement against Israel. So how can it remain on the sidelines of the Israel-Hamas conflict in Gaza?
And later, Israel needs construction workers and will catch up to King Charles on his tour of Kenya. Today is Thursday, November 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. For the first time since the October 7th attacks on Israel, the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt has opened to let people out of the Gaza Strip. On Wednesday, only foreign nationals or people with dual citizenship were allowed to leave Gaza, along with a few dozen seriously wounded people who will be getting medical care in Egypt. Reuters' Lucy Fielder has more.
Ambulances transport injured evacuees from Gaza to Egypt on Wednesday through the reopened Rafah crossing. Under a deal reached between Egypt, Israel and Hamas, and brokered by Qatar, a number of foreigners and critically wounded people have been allowed to leave the besieged territory. Egypt has prepared field hospitals in Sheikh Zayed in the Sinai. An Egyptian security source said the deal allowed up to 500 foreign passport holders to pass through Rafah on Wednesday. But there was no link to the release of about 240 hostages held by Hamas, or to a humanitarian pause in the fighting, which many countries have called for but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected. Humanitarian trucks of aid also rumbled through. It wasn't clear how long the crossing would remain open for evacuations.
That's Reuters' Lucy Fielder reporting for us there. And despite international outcry and condemnation of Tuesday's attack on the Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza, Israel attacked it again on Wednesday. The Israelis say that Hamas, which the U.S. has designated as a terrorist group, is stationing its commanders and fighters among the civilian population there, intentionally putting civilians at risk. Israel claims the attack on Jabalia destroyed a Hamas command center and killed two senior Hamas leaders, including one of the ringleaders of the attack earlier this month. Hamas says the strikes killed several of the hostages that were taken on October 7th. The AP's Charles Della Desma has more.
Israeli strikes have hit apartment blocks in a refugee camp near Gaza City for a second day in a row, causing many deaths and injuries. The toll from Wednesday's strikes is not immediately known. Al Jazeera Television, which is still reporting from northern Gaza, has aired videos of devastation and of several wounded people, including children, being brought to a nearby hospital. Meanwhile, Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati says time is of the essence in stopping the Hamas-Israel war from, he says, going out of control and affecting Lebanon and the wider region. Mikati has been scrambling with other leaders to keep Lebanon away from the war as militants from the Hezbollah group and Israeli troops clash along the tense Lebanon-Israel border. I'm Charles Della Desma.
As we heard from Charles Della Desma, there is growing anxiety in Lebanon over the possible role of Hezbollah, which is supported by Iran, in widening the conflict. Hezbollah potentially presents an even greater danger to Israel than Hamas, but analysts are divided over whether the militant group, which has traded rocket fire over the border with Israel, will enter the conflict. If Hezbollah did, it would likely drag an ailing Lebanon into a full-scale war. Dale Gavlak reports.
In some respects, analysts say Hezbollah is in a bit of a quandary because it has positioned itself as the chief resistance movement against Israel. So how can it remain on the sidelines of the Israel-Hamas conflict in Gaza? People in Lebanon and the Middle East are jittery as Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, will speak Friday. Benjamin Allison of the University of Texas points to Hezbollah's formidable arsenal of precision-guided munitions, rockets, and drones, unlike anything Hamas possesses, writing in the online publication lawfare. He says Hezbollah's various smart weapons pose a serious danger to Israel's infrastructure and could even tempt Israel to launch a preemptive war. Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdullah Bou Habib, argues that neither Lebanon nor Hezbollah want a war with Israel because it would spell disaster for Lebanon, which is grappling with an extended crippling economic crisis. Lebanese analyst Dania Khalid Khatib told VOA that Hezbollah is doing contingency planning and controlling the tempo of tit-for-tat border rocket attacks with the Israel Defense Forces at the moment. Khatib is the president of the Research Center for Cooperation and Peace Building in Beirut. She says Hezbollah would likely only enter a war with Israel in one or two cases.
If Hamas is close to be eradicated, they know very well they will be next. Or if Israel bombs Lebanon. What they are doing now is keep the IDF busy in the north, keep the intelligence confused, and the Israelis scared. It's like front for distraction for now, not a real front. Well, it depends.
Rami Khoury of the American University of Beirut, speaking to the Washington-based Arab Center, says Hezbollah is respected in Israel because of its resistance and defiance, and expects Iran's premier proxy to keep the pressure up on Israel's northern border.
Hezbollah will keep harassing the Israelis. They're testing out all the time the Israeli response, the Israeli public sentiment, the how dynamic are the troops, or are they scared? So they attack a little station here, they send a drone there, they shoot a soldier here. They're trying to create psychological terror and fear among Israelis rather than attack them with 1,000 rockets, which might happen if they get into a war.
And yet Khoury thinks it unlikely that Hezbollah will enter the fray.
I don't think they're going to enter into a full-scale war, and I don't think the Iranians are either. But it's not out of the question, because if the war goes well or badly, they might possibly join, but I think that's likely.
Maha Yahya, director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, told the New York Times newspaper that Iran will likely not squander Hezbollah's force at this time because the stakes are high with two U.S. aircraft carriers stationed in the Mediterranean, which could strike the group. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
To help make sense of all the latest developments and events in Israel and Gaza, VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Israel says that several senior Hamas people were in that refugee camp and they were targeting them, especially one who was one of the planners of the October 7th massacre in which several thousand Hamas gunmen came into Israel and killed some 1,400 people, mostly civilians. Hamas says he wasn't there. Apparently what happened is the very densely populated refugee camp, the bombs hit some buildings, and it may be that there was a tunnel underneath and the tunnel collapsed, and that's what brought the buildings down. Israel says it had told civilians for several weeks to leave that area, knowing that was sort of a stronghold of Hamas and that Israel was going to bomb it. But as you said, there were many deaths. We're talking about probably several dozen killed and maybe more.
Linda, injured civilians seeking medical treatment and foreigners have been allowed to enter Egypt from the Gaza Strip for the first time since the outbreak of hostilities. Can you tell us about that story, please?
Both the United States and Qatar have been trying to convince Egypt to accept, first of all, the dual nationals and foreign citizens who have been stuck in Gaza since the beginning of this conflict almost a month ago. And today, some 400 of them were finally left. Egypt also accepted a few dozen, about 90 severely wounded people who can't get treatment in Gaza. And until now, the Rafah border crossing has only been open for humanitarian aid to come into Gaza, but not to allow people. Egypt is afraid that the hundreds of thousands of people in Rafah will try to sort of storm the crossing point and to find refuge in Egypt.
Speaking of humanitarian aid, can you tell us about the status of trucks carrying humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip?
Israel has said that as of today, it will allow 100 trucks into southern Gaza, not into northern Gaza, which is where the fighting is, but into southern Gaza to try to alleviate the humanitarian crisis. But that humanitarian aid will not include fuel because Israel says that fuel Hamas can use to fire rockets and to power the underground tunnels that it has underneath Gaza. And hospitals in Gaza say that if they don't receive fuel soon, they're going to have to shut down about about a third of the hospitals in Gaza have already shut down. And as the death toll and the number of injured continues to climb, you know, it's going to be very difficult if the hospitals are not functioning.
And finally, Linda, there has been discussion among especially analysts that Iran-backed Hezbollah militants in Lebanon will enter the Israeli-Hamas conflict beyond firing rockets across the Israeli-Lebanese border.
Well, if Hezbollah does choose to enter the conflict, that is going to present a serious challenge for Israel. Hezbollah has something like 150,000 long-range rockets that can reach all parts of Israel. But at least so far, Hezbollah has been very careful. It has targeted only soldiers, has sort of tried to keep this conflict with Israel on a very low burner. The head of Hezbollah, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, is supposed to speak on Friday, but the assessment by both Israeli and international analyst is that Hezbollah does not want a full-scale war with Israel at this point.
That's VOA's Rick Pantaleo speaking with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. The United Nations has urged Russia to take responsibility for the deadly strike on a funeral reception in a Ukrainian village on October 5th that led to 59 civilian deaths. A UN report said Russia had either failed to verify the target was a military objective, or they deliberately targeted civilians. Meanwhile, Russian drones attacked a Ukrainian oil refinery on Wednesday night, starting a large fire and cutting power to three villages. The U.S. Federal Reserve kept its key short-term interest rate unchanged Wednesday for a second straight time, but they did leave the door open to further rate hikes if inflation pressures should accelerate in the months ahead. In a statement after the last meeting, the Fed said it would keep its benchmark rate at about 5.4%, its highest level in 22 years. Since launching the most aggressive series of rate hikes in four decades in March of 2022, the Fed has pulled back and raised rates only once since May. And a six-year-old girl from China's Jingshou province has set the new women's world record for solving a 3x3x3 Rubik's Cube in just 5.97 seconds at the Rubik's Cube International Open Tournament in Singapore. On now to the economic effects of the war. Israel's construction industry has asked the government to allow companies to hire up to 100,000 Indian workers to replace Palestinians who've lost their work permits since the war began. Builders say almost 90,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza worked in Israel's construction sector, but can no longer do so. VOA's Jan Boyshat reports.
In early October, this was a busy site as workers reached the final stage of a construction project near Tel Aviv that included three apartment buildings. The complex owners say the 180 units sold for up to $1 million apiece and were about to be delivered to the buyers. Then Hamas attacked Israel on October 7, sparking the Israel-Hamas war. Suddenly, the workers, mostly Palestinians, were gone. The vice president of the Israel Builders Association, Haim Feingling, says due to the war, Israeli companies and the government did not allow Palestinians to return to work.
Right now, the situation of the Israeli construction sector is quite complicated. We are at war, and Palestinian workers, which are about 25% of our human resources in the sector, are not coming, are not trying to work, they're not permitted to work in Israel.
Most construction in other Israeli cities has also been shut down. Feiglin says local mayors are being pressured to allow the construction to resume when builders hire non-Arab workers. Israeli builders hope to draw from a pool of foreign workers to replace more than 90,000 Palestinians who worked in construction before the war began and have since had their work permits revoked or are not being allowed to return to work. The Israel Builders Association says 10% included Palestinian workers from Gaza and the rest from the West Bank. But now Fagan says he no longer sees a future for Palestinian workers in Israel.
Right now we are negotiating with India. We are waiting for a decision of the Israeli government to approve that. And we hope to engage 50,000 to 100,000 workers from India to be able to run the whole sector and bring it back to normal.
About 140,000 Palestinians from the West Bank worked illegally and legally in Israel before the war started, says Samir Huleileh, an economist and former cabinet secretary for the Palestinian Authority.
It's devastating. It's disaster. And when with it will come poverty, with it will come other kind of reactions. And of course, it depends again on how we can end this war.
The Israel Builders Association say right now, construction sites that are operating are doing so with mostly Chinese workers. Builders say the only way to get back to normal is to hire workers from abroad. Yamwe Shah, Jerusalem, VOA News.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. In the days following the massacre of hundreds of Israelis by Iranian-backed Hamas, the U.S. military has blamed other Iranian-backed proxy groups for near-daily attacks on its forces in Iraq and Syria. According to the Pentagon, about 30 attacks using rockets and drones have targeted U.S. forces since October 17th. Last week, the U.S. retaliated with precision strikes against facilities in Syria tied to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. But the attacks against American personnel, while largely unsuccessful, have not stopped. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
If this doesn't stop, then we will respond.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin warning Iranian-backed militant groups on Tuesday while fielding concerns from lawmakers that last week's U.S. military response to the attacks in Iraq and Syria wasn't strong enough. Senator Marco Rubio.
If we do not have a credible, not just a deterrence, a credible deterrence with the Iranians, these attacks are going to escalate. They're going to come faster. They're going to spread beyond Syria and Iraq. And they will involve weaponry of increasing sophistication and lethality. And that is my biggest fear.
Hundreds more troops have deployed to the region, along with multiple Patriot batteries and a terminal high-altitude area defense system to knock threats out of the sky. The USS Eisenhower Carrier Strike Group is heading to the Gulf, while the USS Ford Carrier Strike Group prowls the eastern Mediterranean. Thousands of Marines aboard the USS Bataan amphibious assault ship patrol near Israel. The top U.S. Marine, General Eric Smith, tells VOA those forces are there to protect and deter, not to go into Gaza.
There is no intent that I am aware of to have any U.S. personnel on the ground in Gaza. That is not anything, as a member of the Joint Chiefs, that I am prepared to talk about or that I have even discussed. We are there to ensure in that region to ensure that American citizens are safe and that this crisis does not expand or escalate.
For those who seek to broaden the conflict and target American troops, Smith gave this warning.
If you target us, someone else is going to raise your children. And that's not a joke. That's not bravado. That's just how Marines think.
Carla Babb, VOA News. The Pentagon.
Finally today, on the second day of his state visit to Kenya, Britain's King Charles III honored Africans who served with British forces during the two world wars before heading to an urban forest to help highlight the crucial role of green spaces in cities. VOA's Nairobi bureau chief Miriam Diallo has the latest.
King Charles and Queen Camilla honored World War II veterans Wednesday at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Cemetery located in Kariakor. Daniel Achini is CWGC Regional Manager for East Africa.
This cemetery, Kariakor Cemetery, is very important to us. Now, the king is here to first and foremost honor the sacrifices of the Africans and who served with the British forces during the World War I and World War II, and is here to support the non-commemorative project of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, where we are fighting, we are trying to look for records of Africans who served during World War I and commemorate them adequately.
A few veterans were present, including two said to be 104 and 117 years old, Achini told VOA.
Now, the veterans we have here are the living veterans of the World War II. They served during the World War II in various capacities, and because they are living and they lost their medals in one way or another, so the king will be replacing those medals today.
Next was a stop at Karura Forest, an urban forest in the heart of Nairobi, to highlight the crucial role of green spaces in cities. Charles were joined by the famous Kenyan marathon runner Eliud Kipchoge. Together, they flagged off a 15-kilometer Run for Nature event. Here is Kipchoge a few minutes before the king arrived.
It's really important for the king to be here. It's important for me to be together with the king, because if you want to perform well, then you need to run actually in a clean environment and breathe a clean air. This is our only home. We don't have another home. We need to conserve. We need to take care of it. But the only way to take care of it is actually to involve ourselves as sportsmen and sportswomen.
To honor the legacy of late Nobel Peace Prize winner, Professor Wangari Maathai, who ran a campaign to save Karura Forest, King Charles, escorted by Maathai's daughter, Wanjira, and local children who support environmental causes, took a forest walk to a tree planting site. There, Charles planted an Elgon teak with fifth grader and 10-year-old environmental campaigner Karen Kimani, who spoke to us afterwards.
I felt a bit nervous, but it all went well and I'm very happy. It has been my wish and I can't believe it happened.
Kimani, who has already planted more than 10,000 trees, explained she was chosen to lend a hand to the king after writing a letter to Buckingham Palace.
My mom got an email that it has been accepted. I'm going to plant a tree with the king.
The king leaves Nairobi Wednesday night and heads to the coastal city of Mombasa, where he'll spend Thursday and Friday. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the United Nations, the United States routinely welcomes the opportunity to discuss concerns related to racism, stated Dan Murphy, U.S. Advisor for Economic and Social Affairs at the United Nations.
The United States believes that transparency, openness, and a willingness to examine and admit one's own shortcomings will lead to improvement and, as our Constitution says, a more perfect union.
Civil society in the United States is allowed to operate freely and openly to draw attention to past misdeeds and ongoing challenges, even when such issues are uncomfortable, noted Advisor Murphy. But this is not the case in many parts of the world, including in China. Indeed, if the people of Xinjiang, Tibet, and Hong Kong enjoy happiness and the protection of all human rights, then we would hope that the People's Republic of China would transparently welcome special rapporteurs to visit China, said Advisor Murphy.
But the People's Republic of China does not extend these invitations, nor does it permit civil society to speak freely or advocate positions it sees as adverse to state interests, nor does it allow members of the press to report without fear, censorship, or arrest. Instead, the People's Republic of China uses its speaking time here to distract the international community from documented evidence of crimes against humanity and to deny the human rights abuses it is committing with impunity against its own people.
No nation, including China, is above scrutiny, said Advisor Murphy.
We call on the People's Republic of China to embrace honest self-reflection rather than continual and unconvincing denials of its own human rights problems. To cease threatening member states that raise concerns about China's human rights practices, and to address concerns and recommendations continually raised by the High Commissioner for Human Rights, multiple special procedures mandate holders, and the Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, just to name a few.
Let us all equally and sincerely seek, said Advisor Murphy, in the words of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the advent of a world in which human beings shall enjoy freedom of speech and belief and freedom from fear and from want as the highest aspiration of the common people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.